Chapter 8. Imagination. Perhaps there is no field of endeavor in which imagination plays such an important part as it does in salesmanship. The master salesperson sees the merits of the goods he or she sells, or the service they are rendering, in their own imagination, and if they fail to do so, they will not make the sale. A few years ago, a sale was made which is said to have been the most far-reaching and important sale of its kind. The object of the sale was not merchandise, but the freedom of a man who was confined in the Ohio penitentiary. It began when I was invited to speak before the inmates of that penitentiary. When I stepped upon the platform, I saw in the audience a man whom I had known as a successful businessman more than 10 years previously. That man was Butler R. Stork, whose pardon I later secured, and the story of whose release had been spread across the front page of practically every newspaper in the United States. Perhaps you will recall it. After I had completed my address, I interviewed Mr. Stork and found out that he had been sentenced for forgery for a period of 20 years. After he told me his story, I said, "I will have you out of here in less than 60 days. With a forced smile, he replied, "I admire your spirit, but question your judgment. Why, do you know that at least 20 influential men have tried every means at their command to get me released without success? It can't be done." I suppose it was that last remark, "It can't be done," that had challenged me to show him that it could be done. I returned to New York City and requested that my wife pack her trunks and get ready for an indefinite stay in the city of Columbus, where the Ohio Penitentiary is located. I had a definite purpose in mind. That purpose was to get Mr. Stork out of the Ohio Penitentiary. Not only did I have in mind securing his release, but I intended to do it in such a way that it would reflect credit upon all who helped to bring it about. Not once did I doubt that I would bring about his release, for no salesman can make a sale if he doubts that he can do it. My wife and I returned to Columbus and took up permanent headquarters. The next day, I called on the governor of Ohio and stated the object of my visit in about these words: "Governor, I have come to ask you to release Mr. Stork from the Ohio Penitentiary. I have sound reason for asking his release, and I hope you will give him his freedom at once. But I have come prepared to stay until he is released, no matter how long that may be." During his time in prison, Mr. Stork has launched a correspondence school in the Ohio Penitentiary, as you of course know. He has influenced 1,729 of the 2,518 prisoners of the Ohio Penitentiary to take up courses of instruction. He has managed to beg sufficient textbooks and lesson materials with which to keep these men at work on their lessons, and he has done this without a penny of expense to the state of Ohio. The warden and the chaplain of the penitentiary tell me that he has carefully observed the prison rules. Surely a man who can influence 1,729 prisoners to turn their efforts toward self-betterment cannot be a very bad sort of fellow. I have come to ask you to release Mr. Stork because I wish to place him at the head of a prison school that will give the 160,000 inmates of the other penitentiaries of the United States a chance to profit by his influence. I am prepared to assume full responsibility for his conduct after his release. That is my case, but before you give me your answer, I want you to know that I am not unmindful of the fact that your enemies will probably criticize you if you release him. In fact, if you release him, it may cost you many votes if you run for office again." With his fist clenched and his broad jaw set firmly, Governor Vic Donahue of Ohio said, "If that is what you want with Mr. Stork, I will release him if it costs me 5,000 votes. However, before I sign the pardon, I want you to see the clemency board and secure its favorable recommendation. I want you also to secure the favorable recommendation of the warden and the chaplain of the Ohio Penitentiary. You know that a governor is amenable to the court of public opinion, and these gentlemen are the representatives of that court." The sale had been made, and the whole transaction had required less than 5 minutes. The next day, I returned to the governor's office, accompanied by the chaplain of the Ohio Penitentiary, and notified the governor that the clemency board, the warden, and the chaplain all joined in recommending the release. 3 days later, the pardon was signed, and Mr. Stork walked through the big iron gates, a free man. I have cited the details to show you that there was nothing difficult about the transaction. The groundwork for the release had all been prepared before I came on the scene. Mr. Stork had done that by his good conduct and the service he had rendered to those 1,729 prisoners. When he created the world's first prison correspondence school system, he created the key that unlocked the prison doors for himself. Why then had the others who asked for his release failed to secure it? They failed because they used no imagination. Perhaps they asked the governor for Mr. Stork's release on the grounds that his parents were prominent people, or on the grounds that he was a college graduate and not a bad sort of fellow. But they failed to supply the governor of Ohio with a sufficient motive to justify him in granting a pardon. Before I went to see the governor, I went over all of the facts, and in my own imagination, I saw myself in the governor's place and made up my mind what sort of presentation would appeal most strongly to me if I were in his place. When I asked for Mr. Stork's release, I did so in the name of the 160,000 unfortunate men and women inmates of the prisons of the United States who would enjoy the benefits of the correspondence school system that he had created. I said nothing about his prominent parents. I said nothing about my friendship with him during former years. I said nothing about his being a deserving fellow. All these matters might have been used as sound reasons for his release, but they seemed insignificant when compared with the bigger and sounder reason that his release would be of help to 160,000 other people who would feel the influence of his correspondence school system after his release. And that was imagination. It was also salesmanship. There were two important factors entering into Mr. Stork's release. The first was that he had supplied the material for a good case before I took it in charge. And the second was that before I called on the governor, I had so completely convinced myself that I had a right to ask for Mr. Stork's release that I had no difficulty presenting my case effectively. The governor could tell, long before I had stated my mission, that I knew I had a good case. If my mind did not telegraph this thought directly to his mind, then the look of self-confidence in my eyes and the positive tone of my voice made obvious my belief in the merits of my case. I did nothing except use my imagination as an assembly room in which to piece together the factors out of which the sale was made. I did nothing except that which any salesperson with imagination could have done. There are endless millions of approaches to every problem, but there is only one best approach. Find this one best approach, and your problem is easily solved. No matter how much merit your goods may have, there are millions of wrong ways in which to offer them. Your imagination will assist you in finding the right way. In your search for the right way to offer your merchandise or your services, you are once again reminded of this peculiar trait of mankind. People will grant favors that you request for the benefit of a third person, when they would not grant them if requested for your benefit. I had asked the governor to release Mr. Stork not as a favor to me, and not as a favor to Mr. Stork, but for the benefit of the 160,000 unfortunate inmates of the prisons of America. Salespeople of imagination always offer their wares in such terminology that the advantages of those wares to the prospective purchaser are obvious. It is seldom that anyone makes a purchase of merchandise or renders another a favor just to accommodate the salesperson. It is a prominent trait of human nature that prompts us all to do that which advances our own interests. To be perfectly plain, people are selfish. To understand the truth is to understand how to present your case, whether you are asking for the release of someone from prison or offering for sale some commodity. In your own imagination, plan the presentation of your case so that the strongest and most impelling advantages to the buyer are made clear. This is imagination. A few years ago, I received a letter from a young man who had just graduated from a business college and he wanted to secure employment in my office. With his letter, he sent a crisp $10 bill that had never been folded. The letter read as follows. I have just finished a commercial course in a first-class business college, and I want a position in your office because I realize how much it would be worth to a young man just starting out on his business career to have the privilege of working under the direction of a man like you. If the enclosed $10 bill is sufficient to pay for the time you would spend in giving me my first week's instructions, I want you to accept it. I will work the first month without pay, and you may set my wages after that at whatever I prove to be worth. I want this job more than I have ever wanted anything in my life, and I am willing to make any reasonable sacrifice to get it. Very cordially. This young man got his chance in my office. His imagination gained for him the opportunity that he wanted, and before his first month had expired, the president of a life insurance company who heard of this incident offered the young man a job as an executive assistant at a substantial salary. He is today an official at one of the largest life insurance companies in the world. At the age of 40, an age at which the average man or woman begins to think they are too old to start anything new, James J. Hill was still working as a telegraph operator at a salary of $30 per month. He had no capital, and he had no influential friends with capital. But he did have something more powerful than either. He had imagination. In his mind's eye, he saw a great railway system that would penetrate the undeveloped Northwest and unite the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. So vivid was his imagination that he was also able to make others see the advantages of such a railway system. I would emphasize the part of the story that most people never mention, that Hill's Great Northern Railway System became a reality in his own imagination first. This railroad was built with steel rails and wooden cross ties, just as most other railroads are built, and these things were paid for with capital that was secured in very much the same manner that capital for all railroads is secured. But if you want the real story of James J. Hill's success, you must go back to that little country railway station where he worked at $30 a month, and there pick up the little threads that he wove into a mighty railroad, with materials no more visible than the thoughts that he organized in his imagination. What a mighty power is imagination! The workshop of the mind, in which thoughts are woven into railroads, skyscrapers, mills, factories, and all manner of material wealth. The Enchanted Kettle. In the late 1880s, an old country doctor drove to town, hitched his horse, quietly slipped into a drugstore by the back door, and began dickering with a young drug clerk. For more than an hour, behind the prescription counter, the old doctor and the clerk talked in low tones. Then the doctor left. He went out to the buggy and brought back a large old-fashioned kettle, a big wooden paddle used for stirring the contents of the kettle, and deposited them at the back of the store. The clerk inspected the kettle, reached into his inside pocket, took out a roll of bills, and handed it over to the doctor. The roll contained exactly $500, the clerk's entire savings. The doctor handed over a small slip of paper on which was written a secret formula. The words on that small slip of paper were worth a king's ransom, but not to the doctor. Those magic words were needed to start the kettle boiling, but neither the doctor nor the young clerk knew what fabulous fortunes were destined to flow from that kettle. What the clerk really purchased was an idea. The old kettle and the wooden paddle and the secret message on a slip of paper were incidental. The miracle of that kettle only began to take place after the new owner mixed with the secret instructions an ingredient of which the doctor knew nothing. Listen on and discover what it was that the young man added to the secret message, which caused the kettle to overflow with gold. Here you have a story of facts stranger than fiction, facts that began in the form of an idea. Just look at the vast fortunes of gold this idea has produced. It has paid and still pays huge fortunes to men and women all over the world who distribute the contents of the kettle to millions of people. That old kettle, is now one of the world's largest consumers of sugar, thus providing jobs to thousands of men and women engaged in growing sugar cane and in refining and marketing sugar. The Old Kettle consumes annually millions of bottles and cans, providing jobs to huge numbers of workers. The Old Kettle gives employment to an army of clerks, stenographers, copywriters, and advertising experts throughout the nation. It has brought fame and fortune to scores of artists who have created magnificent pictures describing the product. The Old Kettle has converted Atlanta, which was a small southern city, into the business capital of the South, where it now benefits directly or indirectly every business and practically every resident of the city. The influence of this idea now benefits every civilized country in the world, pouring out a continuous stream of gold to all who touch it. Gold from the Kettle built and maintains one of the most prominent colleges of the South, where thousands of young people receive the training essential for success. Whoever you are, wherever you live, whatever your occupation, just remember, every time you see the words Coca-Cola, that its vast empire of wealth and influence grew out of a single idea. And that idea, the mysterious ingredient the drug clerk Asa Candler mixed with the secret formula, was imagination. Imagination sells. You will never know what your capacity is for achievement until you learn how to mix your efforts with imagination. The products of your hands minus imagination will yield you but a small return. But those same hands, when properly guided by imagination, can be made to earn you all the material wealth you can use. If you are one of those who believe that hard work and honesty alone will bring riches, you can forget it. It is not true. Riches, when they come in huge quantities, are never the result of hard work alone. Riches come, if they come at all, in response to definite demands based on the application of definite principles, and not by chance or luck. Generally speaking, an idea is a thought that prompts you to action because it appeals to your imagination. All master salespeople know that ideas can be sold where merchandise cannot. Ordinary salespeople do not know this. That is why they are ordinary. A publisher of low-priced books made a discovery that has been worth much to publishers. He learned that many people buy titles and not the contents of books. By merely changing the name of one book that was not moving, his sales of that book jumped upward more than 1 million copies. The inside of the book was not changed in any way. He merely ripped off the cover and put on a new cover with a title that had box office appeal. That, as simple as it may seem, was an idea. It was imagination. There is no standard price on ideas. The creator of ideas sets his or her own price, and if they are smart, they get it. Imagination is at the center. This chapter on imagination can be thought of as the center of this course. Just as all the telephone wires lead to the exchange office for their source of power, every other lesson of the course leads to this lesson and makes use of the principle upon which it is based. The materials out of which you build your definite chief aim are assembled and combined in your imagination. Self-confidence and initiative and leadership must be created in your imagination before they can become a reality. For it is in the workshop of your imagination that you will put the principle of autosuggestion into operation in creating these necessary qualities. Just as the oak tree develops from the germ that lies in the acorn, and the bird develops from the germ that lies asleep in the egg, so will your material achievements grow out of the organized plans that you create in your imagination. First comes the thought, then organization of that thought into ideas and plans, then transformation of those plans into reality. The beginning, as you will observe, is in your imagination. You will never have a definite purpose in life. You will never have self-confidence. You will never have initiative and leadership unless you first create these qualities in your imagination and see yourself in possession of them. The imagination is both interpretive and creative in nature. It can examine facts, concepts, and ideas, and it can create new combinations and plans out of these. You must learn to focus your imagination and to act on the ideas that you develop. This is not an overnight process. A multi-million dollar marketing idea will not spring from your brain tomorrow just because you will it. In most people, imagination is often handicapped by two things. First, it is not usefully focused. It flits from object to object, driven by circumstance. Today, your imagination may be stimulated by a movie you saw, tomorrow by a newspaper headline, and the next day by a bit of conversation you overhear. Its powers are scattered. Or second, it may be in thrall to the six basic fears, creating visions of some rare and dreaded disease, a disaster at work, or a romantic betrayal. In such situations, its powers are at work, but only to your detriment. If you do begin to focus your imagination, it will not take long at all for you to have many small ideas of surprising usefulness. As you begin to apply these ideas, your confidence in your imagination and in yourself will grow. The most desirable and highest paid positions are those which imaginative people can create for themselves. Use your imagination to discover ways and means of stimulating business, and you may name your own salary. Imagination brings the highest price of any ability. It always has a market, and it has no limitations as to value. Business depressions do not destroy the market for imagination. In fact, bad times increase the demand for imagination. The world stands in need of men and women who will use their imaginations. This is an age of rapid-fire change in business. It is an age that was made to order for men and women who use imagination. Not all of the new or best ways of doing business have yet been found. This need is your opportunity. Use your imagination and convert that opportunity into fortune. Create some new unique idea that is sound and sell it. Take the shortcomings of the business in which you work and use your imagination to make it work better. Use your imagination to create a way to improve some part of any business that you are familiar with, and you will soon find a place for yourself. Put your spare time to use by creating some plan that will improve your work or add to your employer's business. You can make yourself indispensable in this way. Indispensability commands a high price and permanency of employment at all times. There are two ways in which you can profit by imagination. You can develop this faculty in your own mind, or you can ally yourself with those who have already developed it. Andrew Carnegie did both. He not only made use of his own fertile imagination, but he gathered around him a group of specialists whose imaginations ran in numerous directions. In Mr. Carnegie's Mastermind Alliance, there were men whose imaginations were focused on the field of chemistry, others who specialized in finances, and still others whose imaginations were best suited to salesmanship. It is said that Mr. Carnegie made more millionaires of his employees than any other employer in the steel business. Among those he made wealthy was Charles M. Schwab, who was known as the most able salesman on Mr. Carnegie's staff. The fact that Schwab worked for someone else did not mean that he was less imaginative. In fact, it could be said that he displayed the soundest sort of imagination by his good judgment in allying himself with Mr. Carnegie. It is not a come-down to serve in the capacity of employee. To the contrary, it often proves to be the most profitable side of an alliance, since not all of us are suited to assume the responsibility of directing others. If you feel that your own imagination is not generating the kind of creative ideas you would like, listen again to the advice offered in the chapter on the mastermind and consider forming an alliance with someone whose imagination you respect and who may prompt you to be more imaginative too.